The radical praxis of figures like Franz Fanon or Milcon Cabral and its seeming failure in post-coloniality. If history has largely proven right, Fanon's prophecies of all the ways that national liberation could be derailed by an international neo-imperialism in collusion with national elites, and if the kind of struggle that Fanon imagined is unimaginable in today's international situation of neoliberal globalization, does Fanon remain relevant at all to the present? One answer to this question is this, that Fanon's condemnation of centuries of underdevelopment, from which I quoted above, can be easily extended into the present and near future in order to make clear that Africa will have paid at least four times for the development of Europe in the First World. Once in human capital through the slave trade, again in natural capital in the extraction of resources during high imperialism, again in financial capital and social costs of structural adjustment through debt servicing in the era of modernization and neoliberalism, and finally in the disproportionate effects in Africa of global climate change that is largely caused by carbon consumption elsewhere. Indeed, a group of scientists concluded in 2008 that rich nations may have imposed climate damages on the poor group of nations greater than the latter's current foreign debt. So this slide goes along with this article, and the red represents the high-income nations. And the red foot is the scale of ecological damage on the low and middle income nations, and then you can see the ecological footprint of ecological damage of the low-income nations on the other two. So you can see the size of the footprint that each of these spaces will bear from the other's consumption. This subversive notion of ecological debt, the debt that the developed world owes to poor nations for having externalized the ecological cost of its own development, restores to view the long history of economic and ecological exploitation all too easily obscured by the market-driven presentism of carbon credits. Here again, the notion of prehistory raises questions about time, nearly as complex as those about carbon. If Fanon can see in the splendor of mid-20th century Europe the shadows of centuries of underdevelopment outside of Europe, can we, too, develop a spatial and temporal capacity to recognize what it means to live after and yet fully within the causes of ecological crisis whose full effects are yet to come in the future and which will hurt most those who benefited the least? What does it mean to inhabit the meantime or the unless of an injustice against people and planet that reinforces and replicates older histories of domination? A conventional answer about the contemporary relevance of liberation theory read through a green lens comes in no small part from just having finished teaching a course on postcolonial theory, in which the two-week unit on postcolonial ecologies was without question the material that most provoked the students to examine deeply the relationship between the sometimes abstruse theory and the immediacy or mediations within their own lives. Many of my students observed that they didn't really get Fanon. What he was talking about, they couldn't really grasp how anyone could argue for the necessity of revolutionary violence until they started working through the photographs and essays in the book The Curse of the Black Gold, 50 Years of Oil in the Niger Delta, in which Ed Koshy's photographs are juxtaposed with essays by geographer Michael Watts, as well as numerous essays, poems, and interviews by writers, activists, and militants in the Niger Delta. My students' argument about trash, which I cited earlier, was provoked by this photograph from the book. We can see Koshy and Watts as something like contemporary Jean-Paul Sartre's or Gio Pontecorvo's of Battle of Algiers fame, using their cultural capital to make sure that the story of resistance to corporate and state petroviolence in the Niger Delta can be told, and stylishly at that, to those who unwittingly benefit from such violence. Bob Nixon has argued that one of the challenges that Ken Zarawiwa faced in his struggle against Shell Oil in the Nigerian state was prejudicial failures of geographical imagining. In American intellectual and media terms, a region like Ogoniland is almost completely unimaginable. I would suggest then that the Curse of the Black Gold enabled my students to begin to imagine the Niger Delta and to trace the otherwise invisible traffic lines of the relationship to it with powerful results. They came to understand very quickly the idea that the nation state is not withering away under globalization, but rather being made to serve rather different purposes, not least to facilitate the work of resource extraction in places like the Niger Delta. Having assigned this book just after midterm to accommodate a campus visit by Watson Kashi, I found myself challenged in numerous ways by the depth and passion of my students' engagement. Challenged first to respond adequately to their visceral responses of despair and anger at recognizing their own implication in a global system in which, in Jamaica Kincaid's words, every good thing that stands before us comes at great cost to someone. In The Curse of the Black Gold, Emo Bossy writes, slide, please. The lure of oil is in its cheapness. Oil is a cheap source of energy. It is cheap partly because oil's costs of extraction are not reflected in the price of the pump. Poor people continue to subsidize the cost of crude oil through the losses, and you're going to have to listen to me instead of reading, through the losses they suffer in environmental services, quality of life, and extreme environmental degradation. My students saw how their own lives were subsidized by the suffering of others whom they will never meet, even as they grappled closer to home with the death of Detroit, which is now paying its own steep price for the phantasmagoric cheapness of oil, and this is something that they are very directly affected by. The broader challenge I faced after teaching this book was how to channel and maintain energy throughout the rest of the semester. Somehow Homi Pabha's essay on mimicry just didn't elicit the same kind of response. My students have convinced me that whatever future post-colonial studies can have, the contemporary relevance of its own liberatory tradition will depend in no small part on its capacity to raise such questions of nature in tandem with the classic questions of equality and justice, questions of self-determination in the sense of both political autonomy control of human and natural resources. Here I may seem to be on the verge of offering my own progress narrative for postcolonial studies, so let me make two very important caveats themselves about the lore of progress narratives. The first has to do with the question of revolutionary violence in contemporary situations of ecocide like the Niger Delta.